Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. In episode 28, we heed the lessons of Apollo and of the preceding unmanned missions to the Moon. As James Head sees it, planning flexibility is one of those lessons. Now, with the Department of Earth, Environmental and Planetary Sciences at Brown University, Head was one of the scientists deeply embedded in the Apollo science team. Brown University, by the way, is in Providence, Rhode Island. In February of 2021, he advised the Artemis mission planners to be flexible in their planning.
So let me turn to Apollo 15 now as a quick example of the first lunar scientific expedition. So let's take a look at Apollo 15 here, okay? So 6 months after Apollo 14, Apollo 15 was launched to the Umbrian Basin Rim, the Hadley Sinuous Rill here. There were multiple objectives. We had basically five major geological objectives, which are part of the overall context. The impact basin, Moray Plains, Hadley Rill, North Complex, and secondary crater cluster. Lots of sub-objectives, which turned into, of course, goals and objectives for specific aspects of traverse planning. So lots of different scientific questions resulted in the selection of the landing site here and also in the traverse planning. One thing that this required was, of course, major changes. It required to change the plane of the orbiting spacecraft, the command and service module, so that the lunar module could, in fact, land at high latitudes. This was a major deal, a major change. This was done for the science, so we could get to these kinds of sites. The second thing was that to get into here, Jim Irwin and Dave Scott had to fly over Mount Hadley, which is 14,000 feet high, and land on this side, the eastern side of Hadley Rill, which is 900 meters deep. This required a steeper limb descent path than normal. And Dave Scott said, gee, Dave, can you do this? He went in and simulated it. We can do that, no problem. That required astronaut interaction, some major decisions on the part of management and the crew. So when they got to the surface, they did it successfully. There's the mountain in the background. That's Mount Hadley. And you can see, in fact, they landed actually on a tilt, which caused some problems getting the rover out. The rover was beautiful. It finally worked carefully. And there were three traverses that extended to the North Complex. The first one to Mount Hadley Delta, the second one to Hadley Delta, and the third one to the North Complex and the Rill. So that was the nominal ones. But there were lots of problems that arose. And these are good examples. There was a limb on docking issue. We were landing in 20 meter resolution images. There was an oxygen leak. There was a water leak in the lunar module. The heat flow drill got stuck in the ground. LRV checkout, when he first started it up, there was a voltage issue. There was a front steering didn't work, et cetera. Things ultimately worked out. We did not, in fact, accomplish those major traverses. The point here is that there's a lot of problems associated with each of these missions, no matter what's going on. So you can see here that these traverses are not the same as this. We had to replan EVA-2. There were no boulders down here. The radar data, 20 meter resolution radar data, had said, oh, it's really going to be rough and bouldery down here. Dave Scott and the stand-up EVA and also actually on the way down, there weren't any boulders. So we had to completely replan that, focus on in-depth Hadley Delta site here, okay, and indeed descoped EVA-3. It took a significant amount of time to extract a heat flow core, but that was the highest priority experiment. We had abandoned the North Complex objective here, and we had to shorten all the traverses. Nonetheless, it was a huge success. Okay, here are the geological maps in the middle there. You can see as Dave Scott is anxiously waiting for Jim Irwin to take the picture and get on the rover. Next. So they did a superb job. They did a beautiful job. One SEVA, three EVAs, 7 kilometer radius, a limb, 30 kilometer totals and 77 kilograms of rocks and soils. Beautiful, beautiful exploration. And they found the Genesis rock, which is one of the major things. Dave Scott spotted plagioclase twinning from about 5 meters away. Okay. The green pyroclastic glass beads. You should go back and listen to the transcripts, listen to the voice recordings as Dave discovers this. 40 years later, Alberto Sol discovered water in these glass beads, revolutionized our thinking about the moon. And of course, we did a lot of examination of Hadley Rill, not just the rocks at the edge of the rill, but also the outcrops on the far side of the rill, etc. And on the way back on EVA 2, I believe it was, Dave Scott spotted this rock, and they were saying, Dave, get back to the rover, get back to the lunar module, you know, you're running out of oxygen, you're behind the timeline, et cetera. Dave said, listen, I have a problem with my seatbelt, because he spotted this vesicular basalt, which we had talked about before as being really important for understanding gases and volatiles in the magmas. And he stopped, did an unauthorized stop. He likes to call it captain's prerogative, commander's prerogative. Got it, returned it, and that's known as a seatbelt basalt, and it's told us a huge amount. The bottom line is, let's go on to look at Apollo 16. Apollo 15 was a great scientific expedition. Apollo 16 was different, okay? So John Young and Charlie Duke went down to the surface. It was launched 9 months after 15 to pre-Mare volcanic activity into the highlands to look at what we thought were volcanic activity associated before the Mare, but after the main part of the highlands. Now, when we look at this, after the John and Charlie got down to the surface, they immediately recognized that we're not in Kansas anymore here, folks. These are not highland volcanics, but basin and crater impact ejecta. They did a beautiful job here. This is indeed very much like the South Circumpolar region that Artemis 3 Plus will discover, okay? We'll explore. The bottom line here is that you are not dealing with a bunch of different specific objectives like Mare, highlands, rills, etc. But in fact, it's going to be really different. It's outside the Apollo zone, but it's going to be like Apollo 16, where you don't actually know necessarily the provenance of individual samples. That's something we really need to keep in mind. So I want to point out that this is a good example on Apollo 16 of astronomy from the moon, the far ultraviolet camera spectrograph that George Carruthers designed and built and was flown on Apollo 16. And so let's go now to some specific lessons learned, and then we'll wrap it up here. Okay, so let's study the Apollo EVA and surface operations. Study the foundation pyramid involved. Okay, basically, we have here, it is really critically important for science and engineering synergism. Work shoulder to shoulder with the engineers and the managers, et cetera, from day one, start now. You should have started weeks ago, et cetera. We all should. Listen to the Apollo 15 voice transcripts and recordings. This is the best thing you can do to get prepared. Listen to the excitement, listen to what they learn, listen to the inquisitiveness. All of these missions are evolutionary. The first Artemis missions will not be Apollo 15 to 17. Learn and plan accordingly. South Polar exploration planning. You're in the highlands. Think Apollo 16. Incorporate robotic rovers for interpolation and extrapolation. Situational awareness. Encourage, train them, trust them, turn them loose. Avoid meddling with the crews on the surface, but help them out. That's a science support room. Remember Krikalev's law, respect and encourage creativity. Fight determinism, which is like, here's your rules, here's your timeline, go do it. Murphy's law, if something can go wrong, it will. It will, it does, it always does. That's why we have contingency planning. And we're heading to Mars, no real-time support. It's really important that, in fact, we learn debriefing, briefing, optimize science support, a two-way sequential briefing debriefing. When the astronauts get back from their EVA, have them debrief you, then you debrief them in a later time, then you have them tell you what they think, have them tell you what they think about the plan, and then you pass up a final plan. This is critically important because that's the way it's going to work on Mars. And again, a science support room, it should be a mission control, but separate location for the deployed instruments, science support room, and it needs to have real-time focus. Science Operations Center should not be in the Mission Control Center, but in fact should be somewhere else that can easily communicate, okay, but just not all in one room.
David Carrier of Lakeland, Florida, has studied lunar soil brought to Earth by the Apollo missions. As part of his work, he uses the term micron. A micron is really a micrometer, that is, a 1/1000000th of a meter. To help visualize that, take a look at a ruler. Note the millimeter markings. Now imagine each millimeter divided into 1,000 parts. Each of those parts is 1 micrometer. In August of 2021, David Carrier described to his colleagues the Apollo experience and the lunar soil properties.
Familiar geologic processes here on Earth, such as chemical weathering, running water, wind, and glaciation, those don't occur on the moon. And the primary lunar soil forming process is high energy meteorite impact, little particles hitting the surface at tremendous velocities and exploding and vaporizing, basically. In particular, there's no liquid water, organics, or clay minerals on the moon. These are the things that give rise to a wide range of physical properties here on Earth. And their absence on the moon implies that there's just a narrow range of physical properties for the lunar soil. But what I'm concerned with is that there's never enough volume to have converted any of the material of the ground up rock, as Harrison just described it, into clay minerals, and that's very significant. Next. And speaking of minerals, on Earth we have about 4,000 different minerals that have been identified, whereas on the moon there's only about 100. And again, that speaks to the narrowness of the range of possible properties of the soil. But today I'm just going to talk about particle size distribution and particle shapes. So the particle size distribution, many of you probably are not familiar with this kind of a plot, but this is percent passing versus the size of the particles. And the 50% by weight is about 72 microns. So the average particle size by weight is 72 microns, which happens to be at the limit of what you can see. So half of the material is finer than you can actually see unless you've got a microscope. The material is very symmetrical. It's virtually exactly log normal. There appears to be evidence that perhaps 1% of the material is finer than 1 micron. And it should be possible to figure out what the absolute size limit is as you get smaller. Of course, the weight fraction goes down dramatically, but the number of particles goes up astronomically. And so some people are more concerned about the millions and billions of particles of small particles that could be of some hazard. This is a shot from Apollo 12. It's one of my favorite. The astronaut has drawn his finger on the mirror, which was part of the television system on the Surveyor 3 spacecraft. I hope you can see that there was some dust deposited on the mirror, most likely due to the landing of the Apollo 12 lunar module, which you can see in the background there. Its track to landing was from right to left, and it apparently blew some dust on the Surveyor, which was just a few hundred meters away during the landing. So except for a few coarse outliers, and those are mostly discrete layers found in some of the core tube samples and the drill core, the particle size distribution of lunar soil is amazingly consistent on the moon to a depth of at least several meters or more. I've plotted the particle size distribution for all of the Apollo sites except for Apollo 16, and this is the submillimeter fraction. And on the right-hand side, I've plotted just the the data for Apollo 16. And the point is that the variation between sites is the same as the variation within a site. So as I said, except for a few discrete outliers on the core side. We never found anything that was amazingly fine compared to the other material, the bulk of the material. So basically, it's pretty consistent from all of the sites. Any exception is because of its coarseness, and that in turn is because it hasn't been exposed for a sufficient time at the surface to meteorite impact to grind them into the material that we normally find. So you might want to know, well, why doesn't it just get finer and finer? And the answer is agglutinates. Small particles are formed into large particles because of that energetic melting and vaporization. They get glued back together again. So somebody's estimated that after about 100 million years of gardening, you reach a steady state in the grain size distribution. And speaking of fineness, let's not get too carried away about the fineness of the lunar soil. Lunar soil has an specific surface area of 0.5 square meters per gram, which is, yeah, okay, that's up there. But then there are other things here on Earth like bentonite and graphene, which are far finer compared to lunar soil. And we're able to deal with those materials. So the gross shape of the particles, they tend to be spherical to extremely angular. They're somewhat elongated, sort of a prolate spheroid with a 3-to-1 ratio. And there is a preferred packing. The material is anisotropic. And in fact, if you disturb the in-situ soil, you can't pack it back to the same density that it was. And the reason for that is it's very irregularly shaped stuff. You can't stuff it back in the same box that you took it out of because it's taken millions to billions of years of shaking and densification to get it to just the right density orientation. And it's very difficult to put it back together again once you disturb it. And for example, the typical particle has about 8 times as much surface area as an equivalent sized sphere, as you can see in this example. So because of the irregular shape, the actual lunar soil particles are more fragile than, for example, a ground up basalt simulant. But that really has no influence on landing, walking, driving, drilling, or digging on the moon. When I say fragile, it's all relative. It's not so fragile that when we land on the moon, then everything crushes. But if you do scrape or heat them, such as have been proposed, and when I say scraping, it doesn't have to be a whole lot of scraping. Solar wind gases are released. They're implanted in the outer surface of the soil, and you disturb it some. And you can get out gases that may be economically significant, probably are. And the irregular shaped particles interlock and make the soil cohesive, like damp beach sand was an early description of the lunar soil. And one consequence of that cohesiveness is that drive tube and drill core holes remain open. After you pull the tube out or the drill core out, it stays open, and we measured that on Apollo 16 to a depth of at least 3 meters. So that's something to keep in mind, that you can have a vertical face up to 3 meters high. So the similarity from site to site, plus isotropic meteorite impact, plus the absence of water, clay, minerals, and organics, that means we can extrapolate to other lunar sites. In other words, I'm asserting to you that anywhere else we go on the moon, it's going to be like the Apollo landing sites. Of course, there will be blockier areas that have unearthed, or whatever the equivalent for the moon is, deep rock or created rocks in the process. But in general, the soil is going to be the same everywhere. And we are using boulder tracks from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter to evaluate and extrapolate the physical properties at other potential landing sites. So obviously the one possible exception to consistent soil is in the permanently shadowed regions. But if there's no water or ice there, then the conditions there should be the same as everywhere else. If there is ice, it depends on how much ice is there. Is it dirty ice or is it icy dirt? If it's dirty ice, then the conditions there are going to be really different from what we're used to in the rest of the moon. And for example, driving across such a surface there, we take in the rest of the moon, the little bit of softness on the surface, we actually take advantage of that when we drive and walk on it. If in fact we have dirty ice that's frozen hard, then driving across it could be a teeth chattering experience. On the other hand, if it's just icy dirt, the properties might be pretty consistent. The ice then is simply a different mineral, but having the same kind of particle shape and particle size distribution as the ground up rock. I grew up on a beach house in San Diego, and we went to the beach every day, but no matter how well we cleaned ourselves off before we went back in, we always tracked sand into the house. It had nice hardwood floors, but my parents covered the floor with first heavy paper and then a rattan carpet, squares sewn together, and in effect it created a false floor like a grill. And so about once a year we would pull up the rattan carpet and we would vacuum up the sand that was plated on the heavy paper, so we preserved the hardwood floors. I imagine that we're going to have to do something like that in a permanent habitat on the moon, a grill-like false floor that you pick up once a year and shovel out or vacuum out the lunar soil that is accumulated there. I also think we're going to need a mudroom like a car wash. I think they're going to do a really good job on the new spacesuits, but I think they're going to have to be like a car wash. They're going to have to wash off the suit as they come back indoors. And of course, water is a precious commodity, but the engineers will figure out how to recycle that water. And so those are my comments. Thank you.
So there is a question here in the chat that talks about the research evidence that electricity is involved in levitating and moving lunar particles, which may help explain its packing. And are you familiar with this? And what are your thoughts on that?
Harrison, you might want to help me out here, but I don't think that there is very much evidence for levitation of the dust. And the early proponents of that raised it as the reason that the soil would be extremely soft. So I'm having difficulty now that to turn it around and say, well, that's the reason that it's extremely dense. So no, I'm not much of a fan of that theory.
Yeah, this is Harrison. I always draw people's attention to the rock surfaces, which more often than not are clean.
Thank you. For me, the most important thing, obviously I didn't go like you did, but the LR cubes are still functioning 50 years later. And if there's any levitation at all, it did not degrade their usefulness.
Yeah, it almost requires, David, that the particles go straight up and straight down. They can't move left or right.
So I hope I didn't offend anyone, Lisa, but that's what I think.
That was David Carrier of Lakeland, Florida. According to Noah Petro of the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, we could learn much about the lunar environment by revisiting one or more of the Apollo or Surveyor landing sites. The Surveyors were a series of unmanned craft that soft-landed on the moon in the 1960s. In November of 2021, he said his favorites were Apollo 17 and Surveyor 7.
I really wanted to just instill a couple thoughts of what we could do to expand upon what will be done as part of Artemis. And of course, Artemis is a program that has been directed to go to the south pole of the moon, 84 degrees, and poleward. But in reviewing the Artemis 3 Science Definition Team report, as well as other guiding documents, the importance of understanding how surface materials, that is not just the geologic samples that we want to collect, but also hardware, how does hardware respond to being in the lunar environment? And of course, right now, there's no lunar hardware exposed at the South Pole. And of course, that'll change very soon. But with the stated goal of developing a sustainable lunar presence, I think it's incumbent upon us to understand how the environment of the surface of the moon interacts with surface hardware. And of course, if we're going to have a sustainable presence, that means we're going to have material, hardware on the surface for longer than 6.5 days. In fact, we'll have hardware hopefully on the surface for months and years that's being used. And so I wanted to present the possibility of expanding upon the Artemis zone to places outside of the Artemis zone, and in particular, a focus on a return to the Apollo 17 site as well as the possible revisit of a Surveyor 7 landing site. Of course, as we know that hardware on the surface does last. We see in the narrow angle camera images from LRO, we see the hardware still sitting on the surface. We know it hasn't been completely obliterated. We also know that the lunar retroreflectors are still operational. And so we know to a certain degree that hardware can withstand being on the lunar surface for many decades, but getting the fine scale understanding of how different materials respond to the lunar environment is something that could be achieved with a visit to one of these sites. Okay, so this is sort of a review of what I was just saying, but again, expanding upon the South Pole, and that 84 degree and south location is essentially covered by that star at the South Pole. And going outside of the Artemis zone would require a visit either to the north rim of Tycho Crater or a return to the Apollo 17 landing site. You know, right now, the longest baseline of observation that we have for surface-exposed hardware at the moon was the Surveyor 3 lander, which was on the surface for just under 950 days before Apollo 12 went and returned samples from that lander. And so if we want to build upon effectively just under 3 years worth of exposure, a return to one of these other sites could fit the bill. And that's not to say that there won't be hardware that's delivered to the Artemis zone in the next few years. We heard about Viper, and of course, Viper is going to a South Pole site. But in terms of getting longer than just a few years of exposure, we really have to go outside the Artemis zone to get U.S. hardware on the surface. So I want to start with a discussion of what we could glean from a return to the Apollo 17 site. And this was all really inspired by this really clever experiment that Fred Hertz at the Johnson Space Center envisioned in the preparation for Apollo 17. This technical report about the photo documentation of the long-term surface exposure experiment really summarizes what he set out to do so nicely, and that was to use the Apollo 17 mission as a natural experiment with the idea that eventually it would be revisited. And I think at the time, of course, we all expected that Apollo would soon be followed by another set of lunar explorations, but here we are almost 50 years later. And I think it might be time to revisit the Apollo 17 landing site, not only to return the hardware, but also other material that was left behind, whether it's the jet bag that includes astronaut waste. There's certainly astrobiological implications for studying other materials than just hardware, whether it's Mylar or any of the other materials that were left behind by the Apollo 17 mission. Of course, there's other material. There's a geologic exploration that could be conducted as well. We've learned a lot about the Apollo 17 landing site in the subsequent 50 years. And so, you know, as much as a mission, for instance, going back to sample hardware, would also build upon the geologic legacy of Apollo 17 and expand our understanding of the geologic history of the moon. I also want to point out that one of the science goals of Artemis is to build up geophysical measurements. And by getting outside of that Artemis zone at the South Pole, we could extend the baseline of measurements of whether it's retroreflectors, because Apollo 17 did not carry a retroreflector to the moon, or other geophysical measurements. The Taurus-Littrow Valley is a perfect location to establish one of those geophysical stations. Of course, one of the goals of returning hardware is to compare it to the previous, to what it was like 50 years ago. And that report, which the QR code will take you to, reviews the photo documentation. Again, what Fred did was image select pieces of hardware at up to 200 microns and parts of it at better resolutions than that. We need to recover the original scans, original negatives that were part of that study. Of course, we also have these wonderful scans of the original surface documentation images to serve as a before image as well. So I think we have a pretty good handle on what the hardware would have looked like at the time of deployment or pre-launch. It's just a matter of going and now exploring how it's reacted, how that hardware has reacted to 50 plus years on the lunar surface. The other possible location, and again, I'm only considering US hardware here, is basically a redux of the Apollo 12 experiment. Instead of going to Surveyor 3 or other hardware from Apollo, Surveyor 7 was the furthest south of a Surveyor landing. It's on the north rim of Tycho Crater, which in and of itself is a wonderful geologic target. Of course, Apollo 12 returned parts of the TV camera, as well as mirrors that were mounted along with that. One could imagine returning any number of materials from the lander, including magnets that were deployed as part of a magnetometer experiment. You know, of course, consideration must be given to landing not just on top of the lander to you know, introduce modern contamination. But I think one could come up with a, you know, extensive exploration plan that not only visits the Surveyor 7 target, but is, you know, material ejected by the Tycho crater as well. And of course, Tycho itself is an important target. We see Tycho ejected material, not only potentially going to Apollo 17, but also across the South Pole. And there's an important tie there that by nailing down the age of Tycho, which is still open to some small amount of debate, we could indeed inform what we might be sampling at the South Pole as well, if there is indeed ejecta contributing to the South Pole from Tycho. As I said, with Apollo 17, this also gives us about a 60-degree separation for a geophysical station. Again, more nodes, broader network, we could potentially expand upon a geophysical network. You know, I don't want to belabor the point, but I think we should consider if we could argue for a non-polar landing site, what will we do there? Obviously, there are many geologic targets to go to. Witness place scientists, not only as part of Artemis, but also reaching back to Surveyor and Apollo would be important. The question in the chat is about why not consider Lunokhod sites. Absolutely could. I'm just trying to avoid any international incidents in going and poking around at other countries' hardware. Of course, it's all there for peace and science. Any of the Lunokhod sites would be incredibly valuable as well, but I'm just factoring in what could be done for an Apollo site here. But certainly we should consider what targets might be achievable anywhere on the surface of the moon. And with that, I will conclude. Thank you.
Noah Petro, who now works with the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, a craft that has been circling the moon since 2009. Here, he elaborates on his recommendation to have Artemis astronauts land at the Surveyor 7 site.
Hey, what can we do in preparation for Artemis? I would argue going to visit hardware that's been exposed to the lunar environment for, you know, at some point it's going to be 50, almost 60 years by the time this mission might even happen, will give us a point to prepare for extended duration stays on the lunar surface. Now, obviously we've sampled material from Surveyor 3. We'll talk a little bit about that later on. We have a sense of what happens on the surface of the moon. Of course, the LROC images shows us that, you know, the landers are still there, the flags are still flying. So we have a certain sense of what happens, but by actually visiting a site and, you know, we know exactly where Surveyor 7 is. So we want to land not on top of it, but nearby and rove, you know, take Emerson's rover and visit Surveyor 7. There are a number of science objectives. One is understanding the lunar environment. What happens to hardware exposed over 50 years? And so this becomes a long duration exposure experiment. Again, somewhat similar, although on a different timescale to what was performed by Apollo 12. Also, I would argue that, you know, by sending a geochronology experiment to understand the age of Tycho gives us a really nice connection to Apollo 17. We think that there's Tycho material that was ejected to Apollo 17. Also, there's a thought that we may be visiting Tycho ray material at some locations in the South Pole. So understanding the age of that event to tie the geology of multiple landing sites together, I think, is a unique capability. And then finally, looking at the regolith development at a lunar site, we get this natural experiment by roving through the blast zone. Tim just talked about the blast zones that we would be visiting, going from Clips blast zone, undisturbed Tycho ejecta, Surveyor 7 blast zone, gives us 3 points of comparison for regolith development. And this was really where Heather's interest, I think, kicked in, was understanding the development of fine-scale regolith textures melt draping on particulates and understanding regolith development through multiple processes. And so I think the science justification for such a mission is there not only to understand regolith development, but also, again, what happens to hardware that's been sitting on the surface for multiple decades. Again, required capabilities, I think, you know, again, a rover that can go from a lander through undisturbed regolith, Tycho regolith to the Surveyor 7 and get right up next to Surveyor 7 for imaging of micro craters is going to be important. This is a figure from Ryan's paper from several years ago outlining the blast zone around Surveyor 7. So again, that blast zone gives us another data point for regolith development from the 1960s to present. You know, obviously, if we want to do any kind of in situ geochemistry and geochronology, we need to be able to ingest samples. And then microimaging and macro scale imaging of the regolith properties at micro scales, but also microimaging of the Surveyor hardware. You know, Surveyor 3 returned with very little modification. The hardware looked relatively new, but being able to identify micro craters that form and just the status, the state of the hardware sitting on the surface after 50 years will be, over 50 years will be something that would be very informative for long duration lunar exploration, which we hope to having as part of the Artemis program. Of course, we want to get the hardware back. You know, trimming off Surveyor hardware and returning it to Earth would be wonderful. And of course, deploying, anytime we talk about near side landing, you know, deploying hardware, retroreflectors, anything that can be part of a larger scale geophysical network is obviously something that would be enhancing and build into a larger scale understanding of the lunar surface and interior.